Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're about to join us for This Week in Law. It is never not awesome when we have Professor Eric Goldman join us here at TWIL, and that is true this week. We're so fortunate to have him. We're going to talk about whether Congress can legislate against online sex trafficking without breaking the internet. We'll talk about smart contracts and buying and selling apartments with them and how they might otherwise impact the escrow business, the legal business, and ultimately all of our lives. Also, Apple complicates things by unleashing yet more emojis. Will we know what they mean? We'll just have to see. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law, with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 404, recorded October 20th, 2017. 404, Lost in Cyberspace. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And no, I'm not lost, and we haven't lost the show, but this is episode 404 of This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us for this show. We hope you have arrived at just the right place. And there you go. That is TWIT's 404 message that you're seeing. You found Leo's Salad if you've arrived with us today. We're so glad that you have. We have one of our favorite guests who was just advising us offline that this is his 18th appearance on This Week in Law, and we're always thrilled. It's never not awesome when he's here, and that is Professor Eric Goldman. Hi, Eric. Great to see you.
Great to be here. I do want to correct you. It is 17.
This is 17.
But we'll get there shortly, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you so much. We're just thrilled to have you. And two of my awesome co-hosts are here with us today. Emery Roan is here. He is a graduate of the California Western School of Law in San Diego. And great to see you again, Emery.
Thanks, Denise. I'm glad to be here and glad to have Eric on the show. We've got some great topics to cover today, so excited to get into it.
Emery's also a fellow these days with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, and you and some of your fellow family or foundry family members gave a talk recently. What was that on?
Yeah, my fellow foundry fellow families. We talked at the ABA IP West Conference last week in Long Beach. Our panel was called Navigating Disruptive Technology and the Law. And so we had sort of a broad strokes discussion of some exciting legal tech issues from biotech and wearables to AI and machine learning to I talked about virtual reality and augmented reality and sort of the privacy and tech law implications of all of those things. So it was a lot of fun. I wish that we had a recording, but I think we're at the Foundry talking about maybe making a recording of that panel available in the future sometime. So if we do, I will certainly let you in the show know.
That would be very cool. And in small world moments of the show, Gabby Ziccarelli was on that panel with you, and she's been on our show before, and she's worked with Professor Goldman on one of his most interesting, fascinating papers on emoji law.
Yeah. Small world indeed.
Yeah. Also here with us is Matt Curtis. He's a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
Wonderful. I get the great pleasure of meeting Mike Keyes in the flesh today, so I'm really excited about that. He and his family are getting into Notre Dame tonight. And but I'm really excited to be here on the special 404 episode.
I know. I'm thrilled you're here, too. I'm thrilled you're meeting Mike. Please hug him for all of us. Shake his hand, whatever you two are comfortable with.
we'll see what he goes for.
We're sad he couldn't be here today. One. Yeah. But since he's traveling to you, we'll give him a pass on that.
I think that's fair.
All right. Well, with Professor Goldman on the show, I'm sure no one is surprised that we're going to start with some stories that involve the social web. Mm-hmm. Eric, you've been blogging about and testifying before Congress about something that we have not yet discussed on the show. I've kind of been waiting to bring it up until we could discuss it with you firsthand, because you have been paying close attention to it, and I think we could get the very best take on it from you. And it involves a proposed law that is called SESTA. What's the acronym stand for? Do you know off the top of your head?
It stands for the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, and that's the Senate version. There's an even longer title in the House version, which I just have summarized by the name of the primary sponsor. I call that one the Wagner bill. So there are two different bills in the House and Senate. We'll probably spend our time focusing on SESTA because that's made a little bit more progress in the procedural aspects in Congress.
Right. And the reason you've been paying attention to it, and the reason we're talking about it today, and the reason we think that it's necessary for people to learn about this law and possibly get in touch with their representatives about this law is that while it sounds wonderful and there's no congressional representative that does not want to do what they can to stop sex trafficking, there are some issues with this law that impact the internet and the way it functions, the way it has functioned under Section 230 under the Communications Decency Act, which is really, really important to how websites operate when it comes to third-party content. And as I understand it from reviewing your testimony and your writing about this, this bill includes some language that would impose duties on websites and web services that they do not now have under Section 230. And it would basically make us revert to a pre-Section 230 world. Section 230 enables sites to take proactive steps to moderate bad things, bad activities by their community without actually incurring liability themselves. But before that law existed, they had a couple of choices. They could either take those steps and be very, very vigilant about it because they were going to be on the hook if there was something bad going on their site, or they could take a completely hands-off approach. So under Section 230, we have this wonderful situation where sites actually can and do take steps to make sure that bad actions are minimized on their platforms. And they're comfortable doing that because they don't feel that they are subjecting themselves to too much liability by wading into those waters. But it seems like SESTA is going to make us revert to a pre-Section 230 world by imposing requirements on sites that they don't know now have. Have I got that about right?
You did a wonderful job. That's actually an excellent summary of the dynamics here. But if I can recap it a little bit and take even further back.
Okay.
So under traditional publisher liability law from the offline world developed over centuries, publishers are ordinarily liable for everything that they publish. They have the editorial control over what they choose to print, and they then have the responsibility to exercise that editorial control wisely. So if they choose to print something that creates liability, they're responsible for that. And the fact that it came from a third party is irrelevant. They chose to publish it. In the online world, there's a lot of other types of content that are disseminated and published that we never even saw in the offline world. So, for example, we never saw consumer reviews in the offline world, both because that niche never developed, no one ever really thought about, you know, the idea that consumers could talk to consumers about their experiences, but also because the liability regime prevented those kinds of that kind of content from being disseminated. Publishers didn't know if a negative review was true or not. They weren't going to take the risk for it. Section 230, enacted in 1996, created a new paradigm for online publishing of content. It basically says, and I summarize very efficiently, websites aren't liable for third-party content. So if websites choose to publish third-party content online, they're not liable for it, even if they knew had knew of the content. In other words, they had screened it or had reviewed it. Even if they get a notice telling them that there might be a problem, they're not liable for it. And that lack of liability enables websites to publish content that they can't vet, that they would never be able to confirm is true or not. And it therefore enables the creation of whole new classes of content that have never existed in the offline world. Other examples of classes of content that never exist in the offline world, YouTube videos, not the professional ones, but the amateur ones. There was no place for those to be published in the offline world, and there was liability for the publication of those. In the online world, YouTube can exist. It can allow the kind of publication of content that without the publisher be feeling responsible for it. So the SESTA and Wagner bills create a exception to Section 230's standard rule that websites aren't liable for third-party content. And it said, if you know that you're publishing promotion of sex trafficking, then you are going to be liable for that. And we can talk more, I'm guessing, about the different ways that, that sites would be liable. There's a couple different levers there. And that risk of knowledge, that knowing that the content knowing that about content could exclude the protections of Section 230 is actually a new change to Section 230. There's no other way in which knowledge of the content creates an exception to Section 230's immunity. So this would create for the first time this dynamic that if sites know that there's problematic content, they might be liable for it. We haven't had that law for over two decades in the internet space, and that new dynamic, the knowledge of content, will create the risk that if sites actually try to take steps to clean up their content on their site, they will have been deemed to know about that content and therefore will have the full exposure that SESTA would create. So It's this little thing, this idea, well, we're just talking one little class of content. We're only talking about sex trafficking content. Why can't we just treat that specially? And the answer is because anything that's based on knowledge of content in Section 230 forces the dilemma that Section 230 is eliminated. And so there is no easy exception to Section 230 for knowledge. Anything we do there will risk the entire structure of that statute.
Can you tell us exactly what websites would be required to do under SESTA if it were to pass?
So SESTA doesn't have any mandatory obligations to police content. It, however, has this knowledge requirement. So any efforts to police content are likely to require the site to do it perfectly. If they miss anything that they should have screened through whatever content mechanisms they're using, then they have the risk of having that held against them and being liable for it. That's why your introductory framing was so helpful, because you said there's two different paths that sites might take. They might say, I'm going to accept that risk and I'm going to go do it perfectly. And I'm going to build industrial grade systems to make sure that there's never any promotion of sex trafficking on my site. That probably will mean a lot of other content will get tossed or foreclosed from publishing. But that's the cost of making sure that we get rid of that one class of content. Other sites will say, I'm not even going to try. I'm not going to go looking for problems, and I'm going to do the minimum I can to manage the content on my site. That way, I won't have any of the knowledge that would trigger liability under SESTA, and therefore, I'm good. So SESTA actually has the counterproductive consequence that some sites that are currently policing against sex trafficking promotions will choose to dial down or eliminate those policing efforts. So we actually could end up with a net increase in the overall quantity of sex trafficking promotions as more sites choose to do nothing.
So I'm going to sort of softball this into you, because I know that you've written about this before and Mike Masnick has also written about this. But for our listeners, Section 230 or CDA 230 already has specific carve-outs for sex traffic, or for at least sexual exploitation of children, right? This is CDA 230E1 and 2 and 3, which say that, or at least 1 and 2, which say that CDA 230 has no effect on intellectual property law, and it has no effect on federal, where is the wording? In shall not be construed to impair the enforcement relating to sexual exploitation of children or any other federal criminal statute. So how does that play in? I think that's really interesting when you're talking about the sort of counterintuitive, counterproductive results of taking away the impetus for platforms to actually do any sort of moderation of the third-party content. Is, you know, one of the common arguments for SESTA is that, you know, oh, this type of rule is necessary to prevent Backpage or other websites from profiting off of sex trafficking. How does that sort of play in to the already existing carve-outs in CDA 230 and also the SAVE Act from a couple of years ago? Rambling question. Sorry, I hit on a couple points there.
No, it's an important question.
And actually, before you answer, Eric, I think it's worthwhile to have you explain what those carve-outs mean. Explain for people who are not lawyers how the safe harbor works and when it doesn't work. There are specific – what Emery has just described are specific examples of when a website is not protected from liability, right?
Right. So let's go back. Offline rule, publishers are liable for any content they choose to publish. Online rule, publishers are not liable for publishing third-party content. So if it comes from users or other third parties, the publishers aren't liable for it. An internet-specific exceptional rule. There are three exceptions to the online rule. So the rule is websites aren't liable for third-party content. And then the statute carves out three categories of liability where that rule doesn't apply. The first is related to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act or the Wiretapping Act and some state law equivalents. And let's just ignore that. That's basically, in my mind, a null set. The second category is intellectual property claims. And because of the intellectual property exception to Section 230, Congress then followed that up with the creation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998, which created a notice and takedown style regime for websites being liable for third-party copyright infringement. And there's not an equivalent for trademark infringement, but in practice, courts have developed a notice and takedown scheme for trademarks as well. Now, the notice and takedown scheme in both the copyright and trademark realms, don't have the same kind of knowledge standards that SESTA would create. There's still the possibility that sites know that there's a problem and have to take action. But the general rule is that the sites can wait until they get a notice, and then and only then will they be liable to take action. So the intellectual property exceptions in the statute don't really change the rule because of the fact that we have this notice and takedown backup that fills in that gap. Then the third category of exceptions to Section 230's protection are for federal criminal prosecutions. And the law is very specific. It only applies to federal criminal prosecutions. It does not apply to state criminal prosecutions. So it also doesn't apply to any civil claims that are based on – I'm sorry. Section 230 also preempts any state claims that are based on federal crimes. So sometimes there's a civil claim that can be based on a federal criminal violations, and Section 230 takes care of that as well. So the only exception is for federal criminal prosecutions. So there's already a category of crimes that apply to online services where Section 230 doesn't apply. And I'll give you two examples where that's been used. About a decade ago, several search engines were prosecuted or threatened with prosecution for publishing illegal gambling advertising. And they settled that case with the U.S. government for millions of dollars. And they had no Section 230 defense because the Department of Justice was enforcing federal crime. Section 230 was irrelevant. Also, about 5 years ago, Google settled an investigation with the Department of Justice over illegal pharmaceutical advertising. Google wrote a $500 million check for that particular case. Again, Section 230 was irrelevant because it was a federal criminal prosecution being pursued by the Department of Justice. So there are already existing crimes that the online services are responsible for complying with, and Section 230 would be irrelevant in those circumstances. In 2015, Congress, in a bill sponsored by Representative Wagner, who's again sponsoring the House bill that we're discussing here, passed a law called the SAVE Act, which criminalized the publication of sex trafficking promotional ads. It was designed to cover the exact same ground that SESTA and the Wagner bill were designed to cover. And it was targeting one site in particular, a site called Backpage.com, which has a major hub in the publication of online prostitution advertising. And Congress wanted to get rid of Backpage. They passed a law in 2015 that was a federal crime and was not covered by Section 230 because of the fact that it took advantage of the existing exception in Section 230 for federal crimes. One of the reasons we're having the discussion today is because Backpage is still around, although they have claimed to get out of the business of publishing online prostitution advertising. And the Department of Justice has not brought a prosecution under the SAVE Act, although they are investigating Backpage in a federal grand jury in Phoenix, which we think is likely to be related to the SAVE Act. And so Congress is effectively impatient. They don't understand why the DOJ just hasn't wiped Backpage off the face of the earth, given the tool it gave them in 2015. And if the DOJ is going to be too slow, it's time to unleash a new class of enforcers.
Mm-hmm. Which is what they see themselves as in SESTA. But as you testified before Congress, and as we're talking about here, the law already gives prosecutors the tools they need to go after sites who actually have sex trafficking promotional materials on them under the SAVE Act, and maybe just because of whatever other federal crimes sex trafficking would trigger that would subject prosecution, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, the Department of Justice has pursued two other sites that engaged in the publication of online prostitution advertising, the Rent Boy and My Red Book websites, both of which they got convictions or plea agreements out of. Both prosecutions were successful in leading to people going to jail and also taking the sites down and eliminating them. And in both of those cases, the My Red Book and Rent Boy prosecutions, the SAVE Act wasn't used. These were actually before the SAVE Act was enacted, and therefore they didn't rely upon the SAVE Act. They were relying upon actually what's called the Travel Act, and then which basically criminalizes certain aspects of receiving money from prostitution activity, and then the money laundering charges based on the illegality of the Travel Act. So there, to me, is no question that the Department of Justice already has ample tools to pursue a site like Backpage if they choose to do so. There may be factual differences between the different sites that might increase Backpage's defenses against such a prosecution. So it's hard for me to speculate whether or not Backpage would ultimately be convicted or would be able to avoid that conviction if brought. But because the Department of Justice hasn't initiated the prosecution, we don't know how that looks yet. And the Congress is basically saying at this point, we don't care what it takes, just make sure Backpage is gone, and we want to stop sex trafficking promotions being available anywhere on the internet. That is their goal. And from my perspective, they may have already succeeded with that goal, given that they've given so many strong tools to the Department of Justice.
You know, I have so many thoughts about this, and one I'll just toss out there while it's at the forefront of my mind is that I don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling about your Senate testimony and the arguments that you made there and that you're making here today. I don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling about them carrying the day here because they're complicated, because when I read through, Mike Masnick did a very nice job of recapping your exchange with Senator Blumenthal, where it seemed like the two of you were completely talking past each other, that he was not understanding the points that you were making and didn't seem like he was going to understand them at any time in the near future. And also, that just politically, for Congress to be able to say, yay, we have enacted something affirmative to put an end to sex trafficking, that seems to be a real driving force behind this law here, rather than getting into the nitty gritty of how it's going to implement itself. Are you also a bit discouraged about where this seems to be heading?
Well, you had mentioned at the beginning that nobody is in favor of sex trafficking. There's no pro-sex trafficking lobby in Congress for good reason. So I am in favor of Congress taking additional steps to try to redress the problems with sex trafficking.
Congress, do you think that those problems can be redressed by amending CDA 230?
So I don't believe that is the appropriate solution. So, but I want to be clear about the real goal. When Senator Blumenthal is talking about his concerns on sex trafficking, and then I'm talking about my concerns on Section 230, in some sense, we might be talking right past each other, because he's thinking about, I just want to end sex trafficking. This is my goal. And then the non sequitur to me is, and creating a significant and very problematic exception, Section 230, is the solution. To me, that's the non sequitur piece. But I want to make sure we haven't lost sight of the goal, because it is such an important goal. We want Congress to be paying attention to this issue. This is something that they can help with, that they are affirmatively taking steps for, and I think we want to applaud them for doing so. But Congress has about 36 pending bills that relate to sex trafficking in some form or another. And so this is not the only tool in Congress's toolkit. Congress can pass new anti-sex trafficking legislation without passing SESTA or the Wagner bill. There's still ways for them to be able to tell their constituents that we have been tough on sex trafficking, that we are paying attention to sex trafficking, we will not accept sex trafficking in our society without going to the Section 230 exception. They can accomplish all their goals that way. However, I will say two things. One is that it is so politically difficult for anyone to oppose a law that says that it's designed to curb sex trafficking. So a vote against SESTA is going to be a politically charged one for anybody. And that's why so many co-sponsors have signed the bill. 35 in the Senate, over 160 in the House. Like, basically a third of each chamber has co-sponsored it, firmly said, we are ready to vote on this bill, yes, the moment it's presented to us for a vote. Because who's going to say, no, I didn't co-sponsor the bill that could have helped address sex trafficking? That's just not politically available to people. So in that respect, I am somewhat bearish about the circumstance here. There's such a critical mass of supporters. The topic is so politically difficult. It is a sophisticated, nuanced discussion to help members of Congress understand the problem. I can just, let me say one more thing. I'll take a break for a moment, which is at the Senate hearing. And then when I watched the House hearing, I was actually quite impressed by how many of the members of Congress realized that this was a complicated issue, that they were dealing with something that just wasn't a anti-sex trafficking bill, and that was it, and there's no discussion, just pass it. I got the sense that members of Congress had gotten the message that this was something different than other anti-sex trafficking efforts that they were considering. And so that was the only ray of encouragement that I got, that I think they heard at least the complexity. I don't know they understand the nuances, and I think many of the members of Congress in those hearings basically said, give me something to pass. Give me something that everyone can agree is not going to destroy the internet, but will also address sex trafficking, and my vote is locked in. But they were looking for, I think, possibly some changes to the law, and I felt like that was a productive sign, though overall I share your cynicism or bearishness about the passage of the law.
Why don't they just alter it so that it is a DMCA-esque notice and takedown situation?
That's a great question.
Can I piggyback on that question? Because I think mine is the same answers. You know, given that it seems likely that something around something like SESTA is going to be passed, if you had the opportunity to sort of amend SESTA or change one or two key parts of it, how would you shape SESTA into something more less dangerous to the internet as a whole? Would it be the knowledge requirement that you're looking for, or the retroactive part of it, or hand that to you?
So that's basically what I've been doing for the last several weeks is given the amount of momentum behind the bill, I've shifted from thinking that we can stop the bill or kill the bill and have been directing more to how can we make this a bill that might help sex trafficking victims, but won't hurt the internet in other respects. And so a notice and takedown scheme, personally, to me, is generally problematic because there are many ways in which deficient notices can create problems and so on. In this particular category, I might not be as opposed. And so to me, I think that is a possible solution that could be explored. It's not clear that the bill proponents consider that to be enough. And so there are some, I think, very strong views on the sides of the proponents that sex trafficking needs to stop and that it shouldn't just wait for somebody to do the work to notify the sites that there's a problem. So it's not clear to me that notice and takedown is enough. Another possibility would be to go back and take a look at the SAVE Act and figure out if it didn't accomplish its goals and then to amend the SAVE Act. That wouldn't require any change to Section 230 whatsoever. It would simply expand the scope of federal crimes that are already excluded from Section 230. To me, that strikes me as another area where there might be profitable pursuit. There's a strong minority, if not a plurality, if not a majority of the bill proponents who think that Section 230 must be changed no matter what. That simply reconfiguring the scope of federal crimes is insufficient. There's also a component of folks who believe that the real goal here should be to put money back in the hands of sex trafficking victims, to disgorge the profits that have been made by the publishers of sex trafficking promotions and put that in the hands of victims. And because of that, it's not clear to me that either the notice and takedown scheme or any reconfiguration of federal crimes actually gets to that point, because those people are looking for something very different. And there really is no way to create the financial mechanism to put money back in their hands without touching Section 230. Or, which I pointed out and nobody cares about, there is a victim restitution provision in the sex trafficking crimes. So if, in fact, there was a successful sex trafficking prosecution, there would be a victim restitution mechanism that would put money back in the hands of the victims. And it appears like my interpretation is that the proponents who think that the money needs to go into the hands of the victims are not satisfied by that victim restitution option. So the short way to summarize my answers to both of your questions is that because the proponents have different objectives, it's not like a single change to the bill is going to necessarily satisfy everybody. And so there needs to ultimately be accommodation for the people who believe that there needs to be a civil remedy with damages. And the people who just want a change to Section 230, it's been demonized to them. And the people who just want Backpage gone. And so each of them has different needs. And so accommodating all those different needs makes it really difficult to come up with a good, elegant way of fixing the legislation.
God, I mean, it's just, as you say, you're not making me feel any more bullish on there being a good outcome here. One thing that's pretty clear from your exchange with Senator Blumenthal is he just wants heads to roll, and he doesn't much care if they're the right heads rolling. you pointed out that going back to what we were discussing earlier about how sites are going to respond if SESTA is enacted, that people are either going to go all in and police in a perfect way. And by the way, Equifax can't even keep our data in a perfect way. You know, I mean, perfection here is just not something that's probably attainable. But that aside, they're going to aspire to that, or they're going to go completely hands off. And in that was the argument you were making to the Commerce Committee, that, you know, you're going to make matters worse because people are doing something to try and curtail bad behavior on their sites now. And if you're putting them in a situation where they're going to be on the hook for liability if they act at all and they don't do it perfectly, or they're going to have to take a hands-off approach in order to avoid liability, they're going to go that hands-off approach way. And they're especially going to do it if they're a small company with no resources. And that's where Blumenthal jumped in and said, those folks are outliers and they will be prosecuted civilly and criminally under the law. And that's where I just feel like the two of you really got to talking about cross purposes.
How do you listen to everything we've heard and then say that?
Right, exactly. It seemed like such a strange response on his part because he missed your point entirely, right?
I will point out that Senator Blumenthal used to be a state attorney general. And as a state attorney general, he was handcuffed by Section 230 in his ability mm-hmm. to go after sites like Backpage. So mm-hmm. he starts from a very different place than I do already. He's looking to he's already personally felt the restrictions of Section 230 on his ability to go and take the actions he thought would be best for his constituents. So, you know, it's not surprising that he's looking to go and as you said, find more people to prosecute. And as for the civil – sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say maybe it might help for our listeners to have a little bit of a clarification, because that's one of the most frequent arguments is that, oh, CDA 230 is handcuffing, or, you know, it's preventing our law enforcement officers from prosecuting people that deserve to be prosecuted. But could you – I mean, this is – bare-bones stuff, but do you want to maybe explain to our listeners what the difference is between a publisher publishing something and then an internet company actively engaging in that? Because, I mean, again, we've talked about this earlier, but if Backpage was actively engaging in, you know, posting their own prostitution ads or, you know, was part of the sex trafficking industry, then Blumenthal wouldn't have been handcuffed by 230, right?
Yeah, another really complicated topic, and let's see if I can keep it brief on this. So Section 230 only applies to the publication of third-party content. It doesn't apply to the publication of what we'll call first-party content, things that the site's employees create themselves, nor does it apply to any actions that the site takes on its own behalf. So, for example, assume that a site that publishes third-party content engages in tax evasion and underreports its income to the IRS. The fact that it publishes third-party content is immaterial to its tax evasion, and therefore the IRS can prosecute it for its failure to pay appropriate taxes. So things like that help understand that Section 230 doesn't eliminate liability for online publishers. It only eliminates liability based on third-party content. So, for example, state attorneys general have for years protested that they didn't have the tools to go after the publication of online prostitution ads because Section 230 handcuffed them. The state attorney general in California finally decided to bring a prosecution against Backpage, despite the fact that she had signed a letter a few years early saying there was no way she could ever prosecute Backpage because Section 230 prevented her from doing so. In the first round, the court agreed with her initial position, said you can't prosecute Backpage for third-party content. That's what Section 230 says. You already admitted that, so this case is over. They tried again, however, and this time they brought money laundering charges, saying that they're not prosecuting Backpage for the receipt of money from online prostitution ads, but for laundering money as their own first-party actions. Now, that's a pretty fine line to draw, and we might disagree over whether that's really a first party or third party liability issue. But the court said that money laundering isn't covered by Section 230. And if Backpage engaged in money laundering, then the state attorneys general have the existing criminal power to prosecute them. Section 230 is immaterial, doesn't handcuff them. And I thought that was a pretty revealing insight, because it goes to your point about the idea that Section 230 isn't a get out of jail free card. It's only a defense against liability for third-party content. But it also shows that the state attorneys general might actually just be looking for the easier paths to prosecution, that there might be harder paths available to them, and that all they're really saying is, we don't want to take the harder path. We'd like it to be easier for us. And if that's the case, that might not be a good justification for changing to Section 230.
There's another really interesting point you made in your testimony, Eric, that had to do, it goes back to what we were talking about in how a site would endeavor, if they were going to go the policing route, to do a perfect job of getting rid of sex trafficking promotions on the site. And the point you made is that defining what constitutes a sex trafficking promotion is not very straightforward. I mean, you would know a real blatant one when you saw it, but they can be subtle and ambiguous as well. And I take it that SESTA doesn't give sites much guidance in determining that ambiguity. Am I right?
Yeah, it wouldn't give any guidance on that front. And like many sub-communities, the community of sex workers, prostitutes, pimps, and victims of sex trafficking, there's a nomenclature in that community that is sometimes opaque to outsiders. So if you don't know the lingo of how people are talking, it's impossible to understand that what's really being offered is sex trafficking. So for example, for a while, instead of saying rates for sex activity in dollars, the sites were using the code words roses. So it says, bring me 100 roses as part of our, quote, date. And something like that, then you can't set up an automated filter. It says, look for the dollar signs. And if you see a dollar sign, then automatically filter it, because there's now this code word that's been developed. And whatever code word would be part of the automated filter, then the community is just going to evolve new code words that are going to get around the filter. So it's really extremely difficult to set up any automated filtering or other ways of checking it without because of the fact that there's going to be slang and lingo and jargon that's going to develop in that community that will always get around it. And that's going to also be a challenge then for any manual interventions. People are going to have to be trained on the lingo, not only what it used to be, but what it currently is, in order to recognize that something looks like a sex trafficking promotion. So the amount of labor that's involved in finding and segregating sex trafficking promotions is actually substantially higher than it might be for other categories of illegal or problematic content, because of the likelihood that it's going to keep iterating quite quickly.
Right. That's exactly what it's going to do. It's not going to be a static target. It's going to be a moving one. There, as soon as people who want to continue to promote sex trafficking realize what's being filtered, they're going to switch to something else. So it almost seems futile to try and perfectly police that.
Right. Compared to things like copyright infringement, where you could take a fingerprint of a copyrighted work and then you could match fingerprints. Because we're talking about people chattering with each other using online media, but still just chattering with each other, it's not possible to take a fingerprint and then look for that fingerprint in the future. So, some of the major online services have developed really sophisticated tools for detecting and preventing copyright infringement. And none of that work really translates well to trying to block and filter sex trafficking promotions.
All right. I think that we've about exhausted this topic, but I want to make sure that we have. Matt, we haven't heard from you. Do you have any questions for Professor Goldman before we move on?
Yeah, just a quick comment first. I think that this is like a classic design law problem where all the incentives are on passing laws, but what really needs to happen is the execution of them, and that's really difficult to do. One of the things that I was really interested in was the distinction between the ex post facto law, which is laws acting in the past between the criminal and civil and how that plays in this context. I didn't know if you want to talk about that real quick.
First of all, I did want to agree with you that legislators are manufacturing facilities. They manufacture new laws. They don't get any credit for saying we could have manufactured law, but we realized it wasn't our best interest, and so our factory went silent for a week, and we just didn't pass anything. So yes, we definitely have a bias within the legislative bodies towards passing new stuff, and that certainly is driving some of the efforts here. In terms of your other point, I'm sorry. Now I was so focused on the first point. Remind me
how the ex post facto law.
Yeah. So the bill has a retroactivity provision, and I had a guest blogger who came and talked about why she thinks that retroactivity provision isn't permissible under existing law. I will tell you that I don't have a lot of expertise on that topic, so I'm a little bit nervous myself about feeling confident that it doesn't work. But I trust her more than I trust myself, and I certainly trust her more than I would trust the legislatures on that topic. So I do think that there's some potential problems about trying to make a new law being enacted retroactive. I don't think in the end it's going to matter except for any civil damages, because there's still going to be potentially a pretty good number of targets for people who are still in the business of promulgating sex trafficking promotions post-passage. So the only thing that really matters, I think, for the past will be whether or not the victims could get damages from Backpage for things that took place before the law. And I'm not sure about the constitutionality of that. My guest blogger said that she thinks it doesn't work.
Yeah, I just think it's really interesting that, just from a layman's point of view, it seems discerning or discouraging that there could be laws that reach back, that are passed later than the act took place, and you're criminalizing that, or not criminalizing. The point is that the ex post facto provision prevents the criminalization but allows for the civil sanctioning of these activities. So that'll be something interesting to see. And also the line between it was just up in the Supreme Court, the line between what is civil and what is criminal, and can a civil harm with grave effects reach to the due process clause and the ex post facto clause in relation to its effect on an individual. So yeah, I think that was really interesting. And I think, like Denise said, you're fighting an uphill battle for a better, almost economic understanding of the law. And it seems like a really hard fight.
Yes, but we're glad that you're fighting that fight and vocally and vociferously and in a repeated voluminous way on your blog fighting that fight. So we're happy to help you spread the word on that and encourage people to pay attention to this issue and know that this law that could pass and sounds on its surface like it could be a good idea could be really damaging and dangerous to the way
I hear any bills that have save the children or stop the terrorism or prevent sex trafficking. Like that should be a big red flag, I think, to drill down into the details.
Right. Ergo, first MCLE passphrase. Yes.
I'm sorry. Before you get that, the last thing. As I said, 35 senators and 160 plus House members of the House have co-sponsored the bill. And if your listeners are concerned about what they've heard here today, and one of their members of Congress has become a co-sponsor, I would encourage them to speak up and let their members of Congress know. My members of Congress haven't, so I can't go and bug them. But many of the listeners here might be in the jurisdictions covered by those 35 senators or 160 plus Congress members. So I do hope your listeners will be willing to speak up, because I do think that this is a nuanced, complicated issue. And most of the members of Congress are so used to hearing from the community of victims advocating for more anti-sex trafficking efforts, they're not used to hearing another side on this particular issue. And so I think if your listeners are willing to share their concerns about that, that would be quite eye-opening for the members of Congress. I really do think that your listeners could actually help make a difference here. So thanks. I'm sorry for the advocacy, but I did want to close that loop.
No, definitely. And I suspect that my congressperson is somebody who might have signed on. I haven't checked it yet. So I'm going to check that and be proactive about it if that's the case. I encourage other people to do that as well. Our first MCLE passphrase for this show is going to be, it's a little hokey, but here we go. Sesta, not the besta. We put these phrases to the show so that if you are an attorney or another professional in another field who has a way of receiving professional education in your field, credit for that professional education by watching or listening to the show. We put these phrases in case you need to verify that you've actually watched or listened to the show. Our first one is sesta, not the besta. We will put another one in before the show is over. And if you are an attorney and want some further information about applying for MCLE credit in your jurisdiction, if you head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. There's a little chart that should give you some assistance with that. Let's see. Anything, Emery, before we leave the sesta topic?
No, I did think that one point that was really interesting that I hadn't thought of was that Backpage as a repository for this type of advertisement has also been a resource for missing people and for families of victims to help find the victims of sex trafficking. And, you know, like Eric was talking about with the code that criminals might fall into if they were pushed off of Backpage. I think it's an interesting idea that, again, you know, we might be having completely counterintuitive, counterproductive results from something like this. But I guess that's also a little more of an unknown. So call your congressman.
Yes, definitely. Before we leave the Section 230 beat, since this is something we are fortunate to have had Professor Goldman on the show so many times, and he is really the preeminent scholar on this very important law that impacts the internet. And if you go on over to his technology and marketing law blog, he and his co-bloggers there cover Section 230 in great detail. And every time there's a case, they consider it not just in its own isolated context, but against the backdrop of all of the Section 230 law and what the trends are and how different courts have gone different ways and what's going on with Section 230. So I really encourage you, if you want to get that big picture comprehensive view of how Section 230 is being applied in courts throughout the land, that is your go-to destination, Professor Goldman's technology and marketing law blog. But let's just talk about one more Section 230 case, this one that you've been following for several years now, Eric, that involves Ripoff Report and is interesting to us here at This Week in Law, not just because it involves Section 230 and the way it operates, but it involves the way that copyright law is getting slotted in here as basically a reputation management strategy. Can you expand on this case for those who haven't been following along with your blog and let us know what's going on with it?
Yeah, and actually I will add it's also a contracts case. So it's got a kind of triple whammy for things that are interesting to your program. So let's start with the basics. Ripoff Report is a consumer review style site, but it only wants the negative. It doesn't want the positive. So it doesn't want you to say, I had a good experience here. It only wants to hear how you, quote, got ripped off. And Ripoff Report historically has been an unusual consumer review site in that it does not remove postings that its users provide. Once the users upload it, for a long time, they never came down. They might be reduced in visibility, or there might be some things that got redacted in limited ways, but they never came down. And so a user couldn't go back and change or delete the review once posted to Ribbof Report. They lost that power. They assigned that legal right over to Ribbof Report. So as you can imagine, Ribbof Report has been a flashpoint for many unhappy businesses who feel like they got defamed on Ribbof Report by a user. And because Ribbof Report won't remove the post, even if it is defamatory, this community of unhappy businesses has been trying every technique possible to try and figure out how can we force Ribbof Report to remove posts when they have adopted this policy that they won't do so. So the particular case at issue here involves a lawyer, of course, who is trying to figure out the solution to this problem because he's unhappy with two reviews that were posted on Ribbof Report, not by a client, but by basically a defendant in a case. So the lawyer was representing a client. The lawyer sued the guy who wrote the Ribbof Report, who said, "I didn't have a good experience being sued by this guy." My experience has been most people who have been sued don't have a good opinion of the opposing counsel. But
print it off and frame that. What are you doing, man?
Sorry. What?
You should print, as an attorney, I would hope you would want to print that off and frame it on your wall. I mean, why would you? That's
right.
Something to
I
be
make
proud
defendants
of.
Miserable.
Yes.
So anyway, this particular situation, so the goal is, the lawyer's goal is to scrub this review off Ribbof Report, which says it never removes reviews. And so the technique that this lawyer tried is he sued the author. The author no-showed. So the lawyer got a default judgment. And in the default judgment, the lawyer went to the judge and said, "Judge, here's the remedy that I want. I want you to give me the copyright in these reviews that were written about me. So instead of me getting money damages or as part of the money damages or whatever, what I really want is to own the copyright of these reviews. Once I get the copyright in those reviews, I'm going to send a letter to Ribbof Report saying, I, as a copyright owner, remove your authorization to continue publishing those. And if you don't stop publishing those reviews, then I'm going to sue you for copyright infringement." So it's a way of getting around Ribbof Report's refusal to remove reviews using copyright as a tool, because copyright's not preempted by Section 230. Remember, we said earlier in the program that Section 230 doesn't cover intellectual property claims. So Section 230 doesn't help up Ribbof Report here, why other remedies would be covered by Section 230. So it's like a nice little clever way of trying to game Section 230, but it doesn't work. And I'll say more about that now if you want, or if you want to take the conversation a different way, let me know.
Well, it seems like the primary reason that it might not work is that I've never heard, and maybe your experience is broader than mine, Eric, that of a court granting someone a copyright in a defaulting defendant's intellectual property as part of a judgment. It just doesn't seem to me like that should be able to work.
Well, it doesn't. The reason why you've never heard about it is because Congress expressly told courts that they cannot transfer copyrights as a remedy. So as a practical matter, there's a statute that makes this impossible. But because it was a default judgment, the defendant didn't go to court and cite the federal statute. The judge didn't do independent research. I don't know if the plaintiff knew about that statute or just failed to mention it. I don't know which one it was. So either way, we get this default judgment order, or remedy order, that is plainly violative of the statute, and nobody in that court case seemed to care.
And it'll stay the decision in that case unless somebody appeals it, which nobody did.
Well, correct. The Ribbof Report wasn't a party to that lawsuit. But in order for the lawyer then to take that copyright and enforce against Ribbof Report, they're going to have to assert it. And Ribbof Report can either wait to be sued or can bring a declaratory judgment. But either way, in order for anything to happen, the parties might have to square off in court, and rip-off reporters have been in court many dozens of times. They've had a phenomenal track record in court. They're not afraid to go to court. So it was clear that in order for that copyright assertion to work against rip-off report, the lawyer was going to have to get into court and get another judge to sign off on it. And that didn't work.
What were you going to ask, Emery?
That was exactly what I was going to ask. And more eloquently stated, too. So I appreciate you cutting me off.
Oh, no worries. Happy to cut you off anytime. Matt, how about you?
Was there a contract issue where they would have assigned any copyrights to Ripoff Report when they, in the terms of service or anything like that? Or was that not at play?
No, that absolutely wasn't play, and that actually was central to the court's resolution. This case should have been a Section 230 case. It turns out that it becomes a copyright case, and then it really becomes a copyright licensing case. So one of the court questions is, what license or ownership rights did the author of the reviews provide to Ripoff Report as part of uploading it? And Ripoff Report used what's sometimes called a layered notice. So they had a standard long terms and conditions that should have been formed through what I call a mandatory non-leaky click-through. It should have been formed where someone checks the box saying, I agree to these terms. And by checking off that box, then those terms become binding on the user. So the terms were presented, but there wasn't any checkbox or other communication that users agreed to it. Meanwhile, there was a checkbox on the page that had a summary of the key part of the terms of service that said, here's what you're doing with the copyright piece of it. So the user checked off the box on that. And so the copyright case, I'm sorry, the contracts piece was not about the standard long form terms of service. It was actually about the summary piece that the user had actually checked off on. So there was a mistake that Ripoff Report made there that was a problem from a contract formation standpoint that was unfortunate. It meant that they weren't actually in the same position they thought they'd be. But because they had done the key part in the layered notice, the summary, they still had the argument that they had. And then the question was, did they have an exclusive license or a non-exclusive license? And was it irrevocable or was it revocable? And the court ultimately concluded that the license rights had been transferred to the Ripoff Report. And in the end, I think the court treated it as a non-exclusive license as opposed to an exclusive one, but immaterial for these purposes. Either way, the court treated that license as not being revocable by the lawyer. And so Ripoff Report got the necessary permissions from the users, via contract that negated the consequence of getting the copyright ownership, which negated the ability to work around Section 230. So contracts win the day. Hooray.
Right.
It'd be interesting to follow up and see if they've changed that to get it right for next time.
I'm pretty sure they have, but I haven't double checked that.
Right, and just because it's such a point that I think people still get confused about, and if you're a regular reader of Professor Goldman's blog, you shouldn't be confused about, because other than blogging about Section 230 extensively, another very favorite and frequently blogged about topic there is what constitutes actual online contract formation, which is highlighted here in this case and frequently in other cases. People, I think, are familiar with a click-through agreement and hopefully are familiar or becoming familiar if they listen to our show and read your blog with the concept that if you simply put terms out there and expect them to apply to people, they're not going to unless you have them manifest consent through a checkbox and clicking I agree. But can you explain – so that's – actually forming a click-through agreement. Can you explain how you also make your agreement non-leaky and why that matters?
So the non-leaky piece relates to the idea that if you're going to have people check off signaling that they assent, there can't be an alternative workflow or user interaction that allows mm-hmm. them to bypass that. So, for mm-hmm. example, imagine that you build the most beautiful online contract formation process when people create accounts on your website, but then they can go on to their mobile device and create an account through the mobile device, but the mobile device contract formation process isn't handled properly. You now have two classes of users, the people who came in through the website that are bound by the terms and the people who came in through the mobile device that are not bound by the terms. Mm-hmm. So in order for the contract formation process to work properly, you have to make sure every user who goes to the destination that you're trying to regulate has gone through the same process or a legally significant process. And we do see situations where people have not handled that properly, where there is a workaround. I call those leaky situations because people are leaking out of the process. And when they leak out, then the contract fails as well.
Right. This seems like a really good time to segue to talking about smart contracts. So let's do that next.
That's exactly the topic of my scholarly writing paper, actually.
Oh, wonderful. Tell us about your paper.
Yeah, I was writing about how smart contracts might provide a better way of dealing with contract formation online, sort of the next step of the non-leaky click-through. But I guess I should probably give a little bit of background on smart contracts, since I know that we've talked about smart contracts on the show before, but in case you haven't heard it or if you're a new listener, smart contracts as a concept, I think that the best primer, the best thing you could read to sort of dive into it would be Nick Szabo's 1993 article, report, paper, Formalizing and Securing Relationships Over Public Networks. It's still eminently readable. It's a quick read. It's and it covers basically all the exciting smart contract applications that are being thrown around today. Including some of the other articles we have in our show notes. But smart contracts are the idea that we can take contracts and formalize them in code so that they breaking the terms of the contract are maybe difficult or impossible, or the contract automatically executes without any third party needing to make sure that the parties are complying to the terms of the contract. I think the best analogy is goes back to, again, Nick Szabo's. In 1993, he described, you know, you can think of the coin-operated candy machine at your grocery store. And so in a way, that's a smart contract in that it is a mechanical formalization of a contract. The machine is saying, pay me 25 cents and I will give you a gumball. The user is then able to assent to the terms of that contract by putting a quarter into the machine. The machine only accepts a quarter. It doesn't let you put in a dime or a dollar. And then by cranking the knob after they put in the quarter, it again further manifests their assent. And mechanically, the machine itself makes sure that that quarter gets to the manufacturer and that the gumball gets to the user. And it's sort of, if you can think that the alternative would have been taking that up to the checkout line to go through a human being, it sort of cuts out that process. So smart contracts are the idea that we can learn from that example and extrapolate out mechanically and replace the mechanisms with code. So again, I really want you guys to read the 1993 paper, because it's you read that and you immediately realize, at least in 2017, why so many people thought that Nick Szabo's might be Satoshi Nakamoto, the mysterious anonymous creator of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. Because all of the smart contracts that he imagined in that paper are hinged on this technology that didn't exist at the time, but that he called an immutable ledger, which is a ledger that any party over the network could rely upon and can know with certainty has not been modified. And so you read that in 1983, you're thinking, oh, that's fantastical technology. When you're reading it today, a light bulb should be going off thinking, oh, well, that's clearly a blockchain. that's exactly what a blockchain is. Bitcoin, if you can think of it as Bitcoin itself is in a way a smart contract, except that the smart contract, it is the currency smart contract, where the entire purpose of Bitcoin is to allow people to transmit value over the internet securely. So we have blockchain as this immutable ledger, which is why everyone's been interested in saying, oh, well, why don't we sell property on the blockchain, or why don't we sell intellectual property on the blockchain? Because we can then have a transaction and then have it stuck onto a global immutable ledger that everyone can rely upon. That's why we see, I guess now would be a good time to segue into the actual topics we're talking about today. But we have, or rather to your original question about terms of service in my paper, was saying that, well, terms of service are in a way if we could replace terms of services and EULAs or license agreements with smart contracts that automatically execute, then sort of one of the cruxes of my paper was that these EULAs and TOSs are already illegible and opaque to users, but that by converting them into a sort of machine-readable contract that still does the that still handles all of the relationships that it might need to handle, can allow users to have tools that are better able to assist them with reading and interpreting these contracts. A bit of a jump.
I hope that the smart contracts themselves that we're seeing today, as opposed to what was envisioned in 1993, can't jam up the way the gumball machine does.
Emery, that. Yeah, sure. Sorry.
Emery, I'm just curious, a question for you. And I'm not as familiar with this topic as you are, do smart contracts compare with things like the old P3P standard, if you're familiar with that one from the 90s?
Yeah, so the P3P standard was the idea that we would create machine-readable privacy policies, right? That,
correct.
Then we'd have essentially web browsers that would be able to recognize, you know, tags or flags or whatever and could alert the user to it. I think that they're a great idea. I think that I was thinking a lot about P3P when I was writing my paper. I don't see right now. I mean, that's sort of where the paper ends and reality begins for me, is that I haven't seen any productive real, like any group actually solving the problem of converting a natural language terms of service or EULA into an automatically executing smart contract. But one of the arguments that I raised is that, well, the impetus to start writing smart contracts has to come from somewhere. And one of the benefits of blockchain and, you know, smart contracts as they're imagined and they're playing out today is that it it creates that economic incentive to start writing in smart contract code. And so that, I mean, one of the problems with P3P was that it just was a great idea but never took off because there wasn't a requirement to and there wasn't really any incentive to. But my idea was that, well, if we have smart contracts that are suddenly opening up entirely new areas of the economy and new markets, then it will be much more common to see smart contracts, and thus there will be more likely applications that are built to help users interpret it. But yeah, it's similar in that it's designed to take natural language and pull out the, you know, relevant tags to let users be more aware of what they're agreeing to.
I think one of the problems with P3P, and there were several, is that there are so many configuration options for a privacy policy that if you were to do a decision tree, you might end up having 1,000 or 2,000 nodes or even more than that. So it wasn't really feasible to convert a natural language contract into a set of binary options for users that could be configured. In the end, the best you could do was say there's certain key attributes that are just non-starters for us. You know, as a user, I'm going to configure it. Anyone who tries to set third-party cookies, I'm just going to block them categorically. And so I'm not going to look at all the other details in the privacy policy. I'm not going to configure those options because there's thousands of them. I'm just going to pick one or two salient options. And that actually ends up being perhaps even worse off then, because users aren't really expressing their own priorities. They're having to prioritize their priorities and only able to effectuate a small number of them. So I think that I think that when you take it out of privacy policies and you talk about smart contracts, and I don't really love the term, so I apologize.
Yeah.
I'm going to choke on it a little bit. And you try and apply that across all the different things that people might be trying to transact, the configuration options become truly infinite.
Yeah, I mean, that's the there are certain things that I think smart contracts, and specifically sort of immutable ledger or blockchain-based smart contracts, do better than others. And I do think that trying to stretch it to terms of service and privacy policies was a bit of a stretch. It was the overarching purpose of the class, and I really wanted to talk about smart contracts. So I might have shoehorned that in there just a little bit. On the show notes today, we're talking – or we have articles talking about the first person to transact real estate on the Ethereum blockchain.
The last couple of weeks, and it happened involving someone very well known, Mike Arrington, former Wilson Sonsini lawyer who went on to found TechCrunch, is the first person to have bought real property. It's an apartment in Kiev, the Ukraine. He paid $60,000 for it, and it was all done via smart contract using the Ethereum blockchain.
Yeah, I think it's not the first piece of property that was sold with a cryptocurrency. I'm pretty sure that was I'm pretty sure that people have bought apartments in Bitcoin before, but it is the first that was handled with a smart contract, and it was done on the Ethereum blockchain. So, and I said earlier that Bitcoin can be thought of as like the currency smart contract, if you want to use the term smart contract. Ethereum was always from the ground up saying, okay, well, now that we have the immutable ledger in blockchain, we're way more interested in the sort of smart contract stuff that Sabos was talking about two decades ago. So we're going to try to expand out the scripting possibilities that Bitcoin has make it complex enough to handle. The goal is, I think, all the different types of relationships that you would want to or need to use in a contract, which I think is a very lofty goal, and I'm not convinced that they'll be able to succeed. But one of the contract ideas that Sabos had, you know, in 1993, that way back then, is that escrow is a type of smart contract that could work really well with an immutable ledger. And that's sort of what we saw with Propi and the real estate sale this week on the Ethereum blockchain. And so it's essentially just a multi-signature encryption. It's very analogous to sort of multi-signature encryption, in that you send a transaction that has to be signed by not just one person, but two people. And there's three parties with two people having to confirm the transaction. That means that you have the party that's trying to sell something, the party that's trying to buy something, and then the third party escrow agent that can then has to sign off on any transaction. Propi essentially is one of the handful of platforms that people are trying to develop to sort of bridge that gap between the code and the application. And they're specifically designing themselves to be – or building themselves to be a property or real estate smart contract platform. So it's – my issues with that specific argument – or that specific article and sort of the headlines that we're hearing is that I don't – personally, I mean, it's probably indicative of just where my understanding sort of stops. But I don't really see how the transaction – in Ethereum, well, first of all, why it needed to be on the Ethereum blockchain and it couldn't have been on Bitcoin blockchain. I don't think that the simple sort of escrow exchange that they set up is representative of all the fantastical theory that Ethereum fans like to talk about, because Bitcoin has basic escrow capabilities built into it as well. You could send a Bitcoin transaction that is set up in that sort of escrow format as well. But it's
just a PR issue, right? Ethereum seems to be positioning itself as the smart contract cryptocurrency platform.
What you're saying is
that's all well and good from a PR standpoint, but other cryptocurrencies can do it too.
And not only can other cryptocurrencies do it too, but I mean, the Bitcoin folks recognize that the strength of the blockchain is entirely because of and built upon the currency layer of Bitcoin. That, mm-hmm. you know, it is Bitcoin is a really brilliantly designed interworking network where the currency that it creates, the process of creating that currency, is a product of the process of verifying transactions onto the blockchain. So it's this sort of feedback relationship. Ethereum, I encourage any listeners that know Ethereum better than I do to please educate me and send me emails and yell at me on Twitter. But Ethereum blockchain, Ethereum doesn't have the same underlying strength that the Bitcoin blockchain does. And also, smart contracts are really difficult to code. And so you're talking earlier about, you know, hopefully the Ethereum smart contracts won't get gummed up like the gumball machine at the grocery store. And, you know, I think that it's that has happened. You know, there have been Ethereum-based smart contracts coded in the past year that had vulnerabilities that resulted in like tens of thousands or $100,000 or a bunch of money in Ether, the cryptocurrency that Ethereum runs on, to get lost, as stolen from fraud. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, programming problems. I've always said that I think that smart contracts in the blockchain cryptocurrency context are the most exciting aspect of that whole space. Bitcoin has been very, very focused on solving the currency and security problem, and they're doing it very well. And I don't know if Ethereum has necessarily made those hurdles yet. But regardless, mm-hmm. the underlying idea of smart contracts being used to sell real estate is a cool one. It's very cool.
It's a really cool one. I'm totally fascinated by the fact that this happened. I think it's really interesting to read the details of it. And of course, we have all this in our discussion points at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We are at episode 404 this time around. One of the things there is a piece by Natalia Karayaneva. Sorry to butcher your last name, Natalia. She is the CEO of Propi, the company the startup that is positioning itself to execute real estate transactions in this manner. And one of the things that she points out several interesting things. One is, as we've touched on, escrow drops out of the picture. They're replacing escrow in the real estate transaction. So if you thought that taxi cab drivers were upset about services like Lyft and Uber, please pay attention to what escrow companies are going to do as more and more of these transactions take place. The other interesting point was Mike Arrington, I'm sure, was gung-ho to be the first guy who purchased a piece of real estate, although it sounds like, Emery, you may
I'll have to pull that up. I'm almost certain I've seen people buy that. Apartments. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, I'm sure Mike Arrington had reasons for wanting an apartment in Kiev, Ukraine, and was thrilled to be able to execute the transaction this way. What Natalia points out is that it was hard to find the seller, someone who was willing to actually accept someone's money and sell their property this way. What they managed to do was find a person who was both a crypto enthusiast and a well-known real estate developer in Ukraine, someone named Mark Ginsburg. So they found that magical combination, and the transaction flowed accordingly. And then the other interesting detail here is that the other, if you think escrow companies are going to be upset about being cut out of real estate transactions, lawyers are going to be upset as well, because oftentimes you have a lawyer, especially in a very involved, you know, high stakes real estate transaction for a commercial property, you're going to have lawyers looking at the deal. Here they did have to involve a lawyer in this far more simple transaction, and that was because of a Ukrainian requirement that required the buyer's physical presence in the Ukraine. So Mike had to sign a power of attorney and have a Ukrainian lawyer represent him because of Ukrainian legal requirements. In the future, though, the Ukraine says they hope to eliminate that need so that these kinds of transactions can be even more frictionless and not involve powers of attorney and lawyers. So I think we're at the beginning of something really interesting here in the real estate realm and possibly in other realms too. You know, as we were talking about before we delved into this topic, it is not very straightforward. And Professor Goldman has been blogging for years about how it's not very straightforward to form an enforceable online contract. And smart contracts may be able to solve that. But you sound skeptical, Professor, that we're there yet.
I just have some questions about what's really going on here. I have questions. There's a couple of different legally significant activities that are at issue. There's the issue about immutable records, that we could have a chain of title that could exist outside the government operated chains of title. And I think that's interesting. That creates a lot of possibilities of ways that we could do things differently. I think that the idea of transferring money without an escrow holder is also pretty interesting. And that has some value. But there's tons of other things that I don't understand about this yet. Things like, going back to Emery's gumball example, the idea is you still need the delivery of the physical good, or in the case of the real estate, there's still a physical item in the real world. And so these contracts cannot be self-executing or self-authenticating because of the fact that there might be fraud at one end of the transaction, that the physical item or the real estate may not be as advertised or even delivered. You know, it might be a swampland for all we know, or it might be with a gumball that the machine never actually delivers the gumball down the chute. So there's always going to be a layer on top of all of these contracts of activity that's going to have to take place outside of the Ethereum or Bitcoin premises, and it's going to have to go to default law or to other mechanisms. So I can't quite figure out where, quote, smart contracts end and the rest of the law begins. But it strikes me that there may be some overclaiming that smart contracts will skinny up the need for all this other legal mechanisms, when in fact it may be piggybacking or relying upon the existence of them.
I think there's probably a reason why this took place with a U.S. buyer and a Ukrainian piece of property and seller, rather than a U.S. piece of property and seller, because our disclosure and other requirements about buying and selling real estate in the U.S. are fairly extreme. And while I am somewhat optimistic that you could satisfy them in this way, you know, make sure all the conditions were met, whatever inspections you have to do and whatever disclosures you have to make, it would be involved, but I think it's not impossible to do it in a smart contract way. And God knows, anyone who has bought a piece of real estate and gone through all the documents and disclosures you have to sign off on that nobody reads.
Judge Posner doesn't read it. He said that.
Right. It's crazy. And I going back to what Emery said about
them, though.
Possibly. Emery expressed the optimistic hope that perhaps if a contract is machine readable, that will make it easier for it to be digested and then recited back to the parties involved in the transaction in a way that actually makes sense to them, in a way that presents the salient points in a way that they can understand. So I think that would certainly help with real estate and all kinds of other contracts. But it does seem like we're just at the very, very beginning of all of that coming to fruition, and we've got a long way to go. Any final thoughts, Emery, or anything you want to add, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, there's Law Geekly brings up in the chat, and I would be remiss to not bring it up, that he says that, you know, smart contracts won't solve litigation, just transactional and diligence work. And I think that's probably absolutely right. You know, like you were saying, Professor, at some point it hits the, you know, what's the proper analogy? Something about pedal hitting the floor or something. It hits the, you know, it comes to the real world, and you have to deal with the fraud or, you know, issues that will bring it into the traditional legal world. And then I also would say that, you know, I am optimistic in a way, but I also recognize the risks that Professor Goldman was bringing up that, you know, okay, so we have users that even if we have terms of services or privacy policies or contracts that are digestible by machines, it's because of the infinite permutations of how that contract can be presented and what it can say and do that users would really only be prioritizing their priorities and would only really be paying attention to, say, like one or two of the things that are most important to them. And, you know, the idea that users may are users more informed if they're offloading interpretation of a contract to some sort of AI or, you know, program. Does that actually make them more informed or does that just make them sort of more focused on single priority points? And I don't know. I just think that the online contracting world right now is a legal fiction. You know, I love talking about the non-leaky mandatory click-through as the best practice, but I think that even the mandatory non-leaky click-through is a legal fiction, just like all the other online contracting, the entire online contracting world. It is a fiction that we choose to believe that people can or do read their contracts. So somewhere along the way, we've got to figure out a better way of getting people the salient information. But
yep, good point. Matt, any final thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I think that just the final thought is that, you know, if we're going to see smart contracts emerge, it's not going to emerge in this way. Starting a two-sided market with two individuals who are unlikely to contract again, you know, if we're going to see smart contracts start in any real way, it's going to start like in a thin edge of the wedge in a contracts that someone like Google or Facebook is doing on a routine basis, and they're multiplying it and making it work over and over again just to get the system down. So this is, you know, this is a great PR stunt, and I can't believe they got the Ukrainian government involved. Like, I just think that's so wonderful that some low level official was level to play willing to play around. So I thought it was fun. You know, just the cost of finding finding a buyer and seller who are willing to use a smart contract is just high in the real estate market.
And also, I think in this case, TechCrunch's CEO knew the CEO of Propi. Like, I think that almost all parties, except for maybe the seller, were, you know, together beforehand. So I agree completely.
Making history, or at least news, we'll have our second MCLE passphrase emanating from all of this, and it will be bye-bye escrow. You'll be around for a while, but better pay attention. They're gunning for you. Let's see. I think, you know, it's getting on in the show. We had several privacy stories that we will get to, I think, next week. There's no need for us to tackle them this week. Instead, I think we'll start to bring this week's show in for a landing. But before we get to our final concluding material for the show, we can't have Professor Goldman on and not talk about emoji a bit, since one of his most treasured contributions to the scholarly realm is his in-depth paper on emoji law. So Professor Goldman and I, outside the scope of the show, have been corresponding in recent months about the fact that I stumbled on a game show called Emogenius when I was flipping channels one evening. It is on the Game Show Network. And the whole premise of the show is the parties are given strings of emoji that they then have to interpret and communicate to one another. So the whole premise of the show is basically the whole premise of Professor Goldman's paper on emoji law, namely that emoji are subject to myriad subjective interpretations. And if they are going to start being the basis for how people communicate and ultimately contract with each other, it can be both interesting and problematic. So did you ever get a chance to check out Emogenius, Eric?
No, I haven't, but I'm really eager to do so. It sounds like a good concept for a game show, you know, how people communicate with each other and all the variabilities. And who doesn't love emojis?
That's right. And speaking of not loving emojis, any scholarly legal thoughts concerning the fact that Apple has just unleashed a whole new host of them on us with its iPhone update? I guess there are 56 new ones coming our way, including mermaids and dinosaurs and various and sundry other things we haven't already had.
Well, it's always interesting when new emojis are launched because we're going to have a learning curve to figure out what they mean and how to interpret them. So it's like the birth of a new word. It's going to take a while for the meanings to propagate sufficiently across the entire community. I also understand that the Apple emojis are going to, in some cases, be animated. And I think those are interesting because we started to see the line blur between emojis as a static item and emojis as an animated item and GIFs and video clips. And I don't know where the line stops then between emojis and GIFs and other types of video. So I think we're going to see some blurring or some dilution of the meaning of the term emoji as it becomes more complicated.
Yes, absolutely. A girlfriend of mine, in arranging a lunch date this week, texted me the shrimp emoji and the corn emoji as her way of communicating that we should go to lunch. And I immediately knew that she meant we should go get shrimp tacos. Right? What other interpretation could there be for that? She did not go for the taco emoji, I must say. It looks like among the new ones we get are a cricket. That, of course, could be useful. A person enjoying a spa day. A rock climber, a curling device, whatever that rock is that is used in curling, because goodness knows how we lived without that emoji, and a pot sticker. Do you have any favorites, Matt, among the new ones?
I think that there was a hat in there that I really liked, but I'm kind of boring with my emojis.
Never have enough hat emojis. How about you, Emery?
No, I think I'm on Matt's side here. my emoji game needs to be stepped up. I do love the idea that we're sort of not regressing. I all my best friends in college were English grads and English majors, so I love the idea of language turning into hieroglyphs again and the sort of interpretive power of emojis.
Right.
I wonder if, you know, Apple, at some point we're going to reach critical mass where emoji will have gone from this thing that's sort of very fun and interesting and open to interpretation to being too formalized by there just being too many emoji to choose from, and you lose some of that mystery of, I wonder if shrimp and corn means corn means shrimp tacos and not just, you know, shrimp followed by corn.
Much more interesting when it's put into a taco, I can assure you of that. Let's move on and do our tip of the week. Our tips have sort of morphed in recent shows from something terribly practical that you should pay attention to more informative about what's going on in the world of technology that you should pay attention to because there are probably legal ramifications there somewhere. Today's tips are right in line with that. The first one is that Pornhub now has AI. Pornhub is using AI to sort through its database of offerings and try to match people up with what they're looking for in a more accurate way. It's actually, it is interesting from a legal and privacy standpoint because Pornhub is swearing up and down that there will be no privacy issues in regard to facial identification. Because they're only going to identify the faces of known performers. But of course, that's problematic because of the fact that many adult entertainment industry performers, I don't know any who don't use a pseudonym of some kind, and revealing their real identity can be problematic, their real names. So there is a privacy overlay there, aside from the very interesting fact that Pornhub now has AI. And then someone put this other fascinating adjunct in a further tip in that there is an app called Nude that will use AI to hide your sensitive photos from your phone or tablet. Who put this in and can you tell us more?
That was me. And I just thought that it was following the same sort of interesting machine learning topic that the Pornhub AI is brought up. And I don't really have anything outside of, oh, that's interesting.
Right. It's very interesting. It uses AI to identify photos that I think you can also add photos and videos manually. And then there is an encrypted vault involved that the photos go into. So they're not just there in your photo list waiting to be accidentally scrolled to as you're trying to find last year's vacation photos. Is that about how it works, Emery?
Yeah, I think it just helps. If you have just too many nudes on your camera roll and you really, you know, break into a cold sweat every time you hand your phone to someone so they can look at the picture and you don't want them to swipe left or right, this app is for you. And it will, it uses machine learning. They've trained, some sort of machine learning algorithm on a bunch of nude photos, and they're training it to pick out nudes and to put them in their own special box with a password. I thought it was interesting. I don't really have much of a legal element to it. LawGeekly in the chat brought up an interesting point that together, you know, these types of machine learning algorithms, especially in like Pornhub's case, you would think might be useful for helping ID revenge porn, maybe, or underage like child pornography.
That's where I was going to go with it from legal overview standpoint. Is I don't think that Senator Blumenthal or other current or former state attorneys general are probably real wild about the fact that there's an app, or probably more than one app out there, that will identify, shall we just call them compromise? Well, nude. How about the name of the app? Nude photos, and put them in an encrypted vault that then can't be accessed by law enforcement.
Contrast that, actually. They might be, Professor Goldman and internet advocates might be a little worried that the idea that actual enforcement of a comment section for nude photos or something might be a little more feasible with AIs such as this. It takes the idea that you can be a platform that moderates and polices the content of your users maybe a little more realistic if you have, you know, the brunt of an AI force behind you. So
what do you think about that, Eric?
One of the oldest internet law topics is online access to pornography. And if we could segregate all online pornography into a separate category, the regulators would be thrilled to then require that to be segregated and kept away from everything else. I'm not sure though about the other issues you guys were talking about, but I wanted to point out on at least the nude app that for me it's a telling sign that that technology can be part of the solution, not just part of the problem. Everyone mm-hmm. always assumes new technology is just going to make our lives worse. And in theory, a service like the Nude app is actually trying to help users better manage their content and better control their privacy. And so I look at it as just an example of how we should be bullish about what technology can do for us as opposed to just cynical.
Yeah, I absolutely love the genesis story of this Nude app, which is written up here at The Verge, and that are the founders, one of them, two 21-year-old entrepreneurs from UC Berkeley who just found a problem that people keep having where they have photographs on their device, and they reached out to people in the entertainment world who might be especially prone to having photos of themselves from various modeling or movie or other acting work that they've done that they really want to protect. And there was no real good way to do it. And so the founders said, hey, we can solve that problem. And they went about doing it. So it's kind of a neat find a need and fill it kind of story there. We have a number of resources for you. The first one is something that you should pay attention to coming up next February, the Content Moderation and Removal at Scale conference coming up at Santa Clara University. Tell us about this, Eric.
So this conference is actually one of my many responses. When I first saw the Wagner bill and I saw that Congress was coming after Section 230, and it was predicated on the assumption that we could just identify one class of problematic content and that the service providers could easily clean up that class and all the problems would be solved. And we know, in fact, that it's extremely difficult and time-consuming and expensive for sites to actually manage their databases of user content. But the regulators may not fully understand what that means. They don't actually have an understanding of what goes on under the hood. Now, some of that's because they don't know, but a lot of that's because the sites don't actually disclose that information. There's a real culture of silence that's emerged among the companies, not wanting to talk about how they actually structure their operations to moderate and remove user content. And so what I wanted to do was to remove that veil of silence that's descended over the industry and put all that information into the public record so that we could better understand when sites say it is hard and expensive to moderate content, we should have some data points behind that and examples from the field that will give us more clarity about why that might be the case and what it might mean from a regulatory standpoint. I've been working on this conference for now over 6 months. I've made over 100 phone calls. I'm sorry, not emails, phone calls.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
That is a difference.
Phone calls in real time with the people.
Like on a phone, not Skype?
No, synchronously. You know, all scheduling to get this conference together. And each of the conversations started with a pitch to the company saying, would you please talk about how you actually structure your operations, that you can disclose that. And then I had to pitch them on, well, this is what I'd like you to actually say. And then I had to pitch them on, could you speak on this particular panel or another? And so it's been like a, you know, slowly, gently pulling the companies along to try and get to a place I think we need to be. So this conference is going to be different than any other conference I think that's ever been offered, because for what I think will be the first time, we're going to have 10 companies who are going to, on the record and in the public at an open door event, discuss how they actually structure their operations, who's doing the work, how they are organized, org charts, job titles, training backgrounds, these little factoids that we just had never had. And then we'll have some discussion in the afternoon where we'll talk about some of the thematic issues, like what are the machines at better than the humans, or what are the humans better at than the machines, or what do you do in terms of providing transparency and maybe an appeals process to users whose content has been subject to moderation or removal. So we'll have a bunch of thematic topics. But the centerpiece of this is to get this information out into the public so that we can fully understand what is involved, and then we can have a discussion about the policy implications of that. There is a conference registration fee that is, for most businesses, relatively nominal. If any of your listeners want to come to the conference but would find the registration fee objectionable, just have them email me. We're not looking for the money. We're just excited about having this conversation.
It sounds amazing, Eric. I'm so glad you're putting this together. The only thing I would say is the title of the conference is a little on the dry side, content moderation and removal at scale. And you might want to get Reverb Mike from our chat room involved because he recently chimed in chat when we were talking about the Nude app. Nude covers your hoo-ha with a ho-ho pic. And it seems like your conference title could use just that kind of talent.
I'm pretty confident that there will be no hoo-has or yahoos on display. But can I add, actually, this is no joke. So we are going to have a DC companion event that's going to be offered. Actually, go a few weeks before the one in Silicon Valley. And we're working on the structure of that event. It'll be similar, but it'll take a few different things. But we spent the most time in the organization calls talking about the title. Because apparently in DC, everything gets acronymed. So the whole goal was to come up with an acronym that would work for DC event. That's what we spent the most time talking about. And the current hypothesis was that they were going to distill the event title down to COMO, which was going to be short for content moderation. So
I like it.
So yes, the titling is no joke. Something that people have been quite worked up about. And in DC, they have different norms about titles than we do in the Silicon Valley.
And Como rhymes with ho-ho, so it works.
Well, I was saying that it was kind of, you know, it made me think of something like coho, like they should have a whole salmon theme, or maybe like FOMO. You have a fear of missing out on the Como event. Yes. So there's a lot of ways.
It's like some hipster neighborhood. Well, you know, listeners, if you're ever concerned about how little or is being done in Washington, just remember how many brain cycles have to be devoted to making good acronyms. Acronames, I think. Acronames are if you can pronounce it right. Acronyms are if they're just, I don't know. It's there's something about that. Acronyms versus acronames. Someone will email me and correct me.
Yes, they will. We've got one other resource for you that if you're someone who's interested in learning more about smart contracts, there is something out there called internetofagreements.com that I actually don't know that much about. I'm just tossing it out there for you. It seems to be about organizing materials and aggregating interesting events and materials and scholarship perhaps on smart contracts. They link out to something from the World Government Summit that had to do with smart contracts. And they call it, let me see, let me click back here and see how they've actually characterized that, the Internet of Agreements paper. And it's pretty detailed on what it's all about. So just some more information there for you about, here's what the title of the paper is, Building the Hyperconnected Future on Blockchains. Did you look at all of this in connection with your paper, Emery? Is this old news for you?
Yeah, I mean, this came out after I was working on my paper, but I did read through the white paper they published. And it's so tough to speak about these issues because there's so much unknown in the industry, and there's definitely some people that are claiming more than they can deliver and some people that are doing the opposite. So I am a little reticent to say that these people are definitely going to succeed, but it's an interesting idea. I think that, again, Nick Szabos formalizing and securing relationships over public networks. It's available on the internet for free, obviously. And it honestly outlines out a lot of the ideas that Materium in the Internet of Agreements paper put forward. There's especially in the smart contract world, there's this rash of initial coin offerings and or ICOs and sort of scammy companies. But you know, there's a handful of projects and companies and platforms that people are trying to build to sort of provide that that UX and interface to smart contracts. And the Internet of Agreements appears to be another one of them.
Right. Well, that's clearly one of our resources of the week as well, since we've mentioned it several times on the show. Please send me the link, Emery, and we'll put it in our discussion points that we've already mentioned at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. Also, if you're a Flipboard person, we put all our discussion points as well as other material suggestions that people send us. We have various people contributing to our Flipboard magazine. So you're going to see the things that we talk about on the show there. It's at flipboard.com/dhowell. And then find the This Week in Law magazine that I maintain on Flipboard. You'll find our discussion points there, as well as, you know, as I said, several people contribute to it. You're more than welcome to contribute to it. If you find yourself stumbling on items in your various travels around the web and life and say, hey, that's a good topic for This Week in Law, if you'd like to then dump it into a Flipboard magazine about the show or connected with the show, please do let me know, and I'll add you as one of our Flipboard contributors there. I'm at denise@twit.tv if you'd like to do that. This, as we mentioned, is our 404th episode. I asked last week for people to submit interesting 404 pages. Listener Curtis Bolt did so. So in his honor, we will feature the Leica camera 404 page, which for some reason brings you to a herd of sheep. They're very nice sheep. I don't know what they have to do with Leica cameras, but we thought you might like to see that.
I think the question might be why other 404 pages don't bring you to sheep.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We had the NPR one that I just somehow went flying out of our there we go. Now it's up on the screen. It left the rundown. The 404 NPR page is wonderful because it's all about lost people and things. So it takes you to a collection of interesting material about lost people and things. The Google one, of course, has been around forever and ever and has not changed in years, but it's pretty cute. It's a little falling apart robot trying to repair itself. And of course, you saw our twit one with Leo's salad. I also liked the GitHub one because it invokes Star Trek and has this very, very cute graphic of Star Wars.
Whoa,
watching way too much Discovery. I have Star Trek on the brain these days. Star Wars with a Jedi next to a land speeder on Tatooine. Very, very cute 404 over at GitHub. And even our animal selfie of the week this week has to do with lost things in honor of our 404 episode here. There is a police officer in Taunton, not to be confused with anything from Star Wars, but this involves a police officer in Taunton, Massachusetts, who is nicknamed the Dog Whisperer. And what he repeatedly does, he has just sort of become their go-to person in the Taunton Police Department for helping lost dogs connect with their owners, because he takes selfies with the lost dogs and posts them to the police department's Facebook page, or has their Facebook person do that, and has actually connected up a number of lost animals with their owners in this way. So thank you to Officer Evan Levine from Taunton, Massachusetts, for your various animal selfies that are helping lost animals reconnect with their owners and not be a 404 dog. It's been really, really fun chatting with you all today. So much fun to get together with you for the 17th time, Professor Goldman.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's always fun.
We've already plugged the upcoming Content Moderation and Removal at Scale conference. Anything else going on at Santa Clara University that you'd like to let people know about before we sign off for the day?
open-ended question too, like that. I could fill up all the time. But Content Moderation and Removal at Scale conference has been a major project of mine this year. So I'm super happy that you promoted it. Thank you for doing that.
You're very welcome. So wonderful to see you. I know here's something that you should promote, though, to our lawyer listeners out there. You're going to be speaking at a state bar event soon, correct?
Yeah, I'm speaking at the IP Institute put on by the California State Bar's IP section. I'm doing that in Newport Beach, and I'm doing that on November 3rd. So if you're at the conference, hit me up, let me know. Be happy to see you. And this may be a chance for Denise and I to get together in physical space for what seems like it's been many, many years. I can't even remember the last time we had a chance to visit in the real world, Denise.
Yeah, I'm thinking it might have been at Stanford at the e-commerce conference they do there every year. But that was years and years ago the last time I went. So I'm really looking forward to seeing you down here in my neck of the woods. It's going to be great.
Super exciting.
Me too. And then Matt gets to get together with Mike tonight in his neck of the woods. That'll be exciting too. Please, again, greet him for us. Tell him we missed him.
Yeah, I'm excited. Him and his whole family are in for the weekend, so this will be fun.
It will be fun. Matt Curtis, thank you so much for joining us once again. Other than getting together with Mike, anything else you want to let folks know about?
We're still working on what we were working on last year, which was an ovarian cancer diagnostic, and we're getting good market feedback and plugging along. And so that's been a big project. And so that's my only update, where we should be locking down some funding and going to clinical trial soon. So that's exciting.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah, keep us posted on that. Emery Roan, so great to see you again.
Yeah, it was a blast. Thanks for having me, Professor Goldman. It was amazing. Great to talk to you.
What a pleasure.
Pleasure all around for all of us, and hopefully for you too. We're so glad that you've been able to join us on this episode of This Week in Law. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. That's where you can find us going at it when you go to twit.tv and watch our live stream at that time. But don't worry about it if that doesn't fit into your schedule. If you go over to twit.tv/twill, that's our show page, and it will give you all kinds of information about how you can enjoy the show on whatever device you choose, be it your phone, your TV, your tablet, what have you, your computer, maybe on your desktop. All kinds of ways to enjoy the show on your own time and how it works for you. So we're just glad that you join us wherever, whenever, and however you can. And we're also glad that you take the opportunity, and so many of you do, to get in touch with us between the shows. You can go to our Facebook page. That's where we post up things that we're thinking about, talking about during the week leading up to the show. Lots of people post things there that they want us to see and consider for having on the show. So please continue to do that. You can get in touch with us by email. I'm Denise@twit.tv. Emery is Emery@twit.tv. Matt is Matt@twit.tv, or Matt C@twit.tv. Sorry about that. You can hit us up on Twitter. We're all on there. And those are really the best ways to get in touch. Please just continue to do so. We love hearing from you with your topic ideas, your feedback about what we discussed, things that popped into your head while we were discussing that you want to say, oh, and did you think about this? We love having your follow-ups from our discussions, also your suggestions of people that you think we should invite on the show. We're happy to reach out to interesting people from all walks of life who might have some interesting insights on the intersection of technology and law. So with that, we will sign off and see you next week. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you so much to our wonderful panel for being here this week. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.